Well, regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Welcome to another edition of Bearing Arms, Cam and Company. My name is Cam Edwards. Glad you're with me on the program today. Sorry for my absence yesterday. I started feeling a little cruddy Monday afternoon. I had that tickle in the back of the throat. And you're like, ah, boy, cold's coming on. By like 2 o'clock Tuesday morning, I was violently shaking. I was so cold underneath my covers. And then about an hour and a half later, I was kicking everything off because I was so hot. It's rare that I get sick. I've generally, knock on wood, got a pretty good immune system. But strep throat. So I am feeling marginally better today. I'm not feeling as good as I thought I was this morning. Let's put it that way. But still able to sit down behind the microphone and talk with Mr. Jim Wallace of the Gun Owners Action League, who is our guest on today's Bearing Arms, Cam and Company. The state of Massachusetts just issuing a new report on the red flag petitions that were issued in the state last year. And, it's interesting what is in there, but it's even more interesting what is not in that report. As Jim Wallace explains, take a look and a listen. Jim, thanks so much for coming to the show. It's good to see you again, sir.
Well, here we are in the great winter wonderland. I got up and came to the office this morning and I checked the temperature on the car and it just said no. It didn't even want to tell me what it was. So
yeah.
As always, welcome back to the battleground state. It just continues. And it's funny, the 250th anniversary of Lexington and Concord's coming up in April. And we're trying to figure out what we can do for that. And we're thinking of T-shirts and banners that just say, well, the battle continues. It's kind of ironic that in the same state that they're celebrating victory 250 years ago, the state is still trying to take your guns and even your black powder. So, I'm not sure how much they should celebrate, but they will. So anyway, just a little side.
No, that's absolutely. I mean, listen, there's a lot to talk about, right? Because we still have, chapter 135, which is, still provisions of this or portions of this are still not in effect. They'll be coming into effect maybe this year, maybe next year. You've got the lawsuits gun underway. Over at the Gun Owners Action League's website, gold.org, you posted something about the recent report by the Massachusetts trial court on extreme risk protection orders. And I thought this was fascinating, Jim. First of all, there were not many red flag orders issued in Massachusetts, 24 last year. Now, that is the most in one calendar year that Massachusetts has ever had. But what's really interesting is that there's almost no information about the details of these extreme risk protection orders, right? And listen, we don't need to know people's names or addresses, but I mean, there's some very basic facts that are left out of this report.
Yeah, and interestingly enough, if you read the fine print at number 24, it says some of those could be duplicates. So we're not even sure what that means. We issued out an article, letter, if you want to call it that, basically calling the report out because you're not giving us any information that might be useful. The small number has always been that way since this thing has been enacted. I don't know, when was that, 5 or 6 years ago? And in Chapter 135, they greatly increased the people who can actually file a petition against you, to include marriage counselors, school people, probably your trash man, I guess. I don't know. I mean, it's a huge list of people that can now file a petition. And I kind of inquired as to why are we expanding this so much? And off the record, I was told that they are very disappointed that more haven't been filed. So they're trying to get more people who can file them to file them. So, and mostly in the past, those were filed by police, not by your average citizen. Mm-hmm. So they are very unhappy that this hasn't become this massive campaign to basically take away people's Second Amendment civil rights. But not more importantly, but as a very important side issue, when this was being debated, I asked, okay, so there's two ways, two things you're looking at. One is somebody may be suicidal and you want to prevent that. So you file a petition against somebody and you bring them to court. In my opinion, you've probably exacerbated their situation because now you've embarrassed them. And the judge says, yeah, I agree, after whatever hearings they have, which, you know, as far as I'm concerned, are unconstitutional, but let's set that aside for a minute. And they say, yeah, okay, we agree, this person's in trouble. So they take away their gun license. The person has to surrender their firearms. Then what?
Right.
In Massachusetts, suicide by hanging is more than guns, drugs, and poisons combined. And, well, almost more. And I always kind of laugh at the folks about the guns, though. Well, yeah, but there's more success in gun suicides than there is hanging. Wait a minute. So even though successful suicides by hanging outnumber almost everything, you're telling me there's probably twice as many attempts? So that's even worse. And these people are getting no help. But the state said, oh, we're going to give them a pamphlet on how to get help. So on the other side now, we're talking about identifying the next mass murderer that might kill our kids.
Right.
So you issue a petition. Court goes through whatever they go through. Court says, yeah, this person's dangerous to the general public. So all you're going to do is take away their gun license. They have to surrender their firearms and you send them home. Well, wait a minute here. You're not even going to do a 72-hour evaluation in Massachusetts. It's called a Section 12 to have some experts maybe look at this person. You know, whether it's true or not, I can't tell you, but we were told no way, you're not going to do that. Because the 72-hour evaluations and the dangerousness hearings are lopsided as far as race. So that's a difficult argument to get into, but you've just declared this person to be a danger. The other question is, can they work in a school? Can they drive a school bus? Can they drive a tractor trailer full of gasoline? And I was told point blank, well, you can't take away their right to work. You just told me this is the next mass murderer. You're darn right I can restrict where they work.
Yeah.
But there is absolutely none of this. And there's no breakdown in this stupid report about which side these things are on, whether they're suicidal or homicidal. So, yeah, a lot missing.
Yeah, a lot missing. And as you say, I mean, there are just some inherent problems with these red flag laws. And you laid out some of these things, right? If somebody really is a danger to themselves or others, all right, well, taking away their legally owned guns doesn't turn them into a non-dangerous person, right? If somebody is struggling with mental health, taking away their guns and leaving them to their own devices doesn't solve the problem. You know, I think in some ways this is a shortcut. It allows lawmakers to say, look, we're doing something, right? But they don't want to spend the money to have a robust mental health system. Again, that costs significant, you know, funds. They don't want to move this into the criminal justice system, right? Because then, well, you know, the standard of proof is a lot higher, right? So they like that low burden of proof for a judge, particularly when you're trying to talk about taking somebody's guns away. So, you know, there are a lot of dodges, I think, that are built into these red flag laws that specifically allow lawmakers to get away with these things, right? With not addressing the fundamental issue, which is if somebody is a danger to themselves or others, you got to deal with that individual, right? It's not their guns that are the problem. It's the individual who's the problem. And this is a gun-related law that says take the gun away and the problem is solved. And I don't think that that's the case. Again, the lack of transparency about some of these particulars is also really astounding. You know, I would also like to know the outcome of these cases, right? If somebody had a ERPO filed against them and they unalived themselves at some point during the calendar year, Shouldn't we know that? I mean, doesn't that, you know, have some impact on the success of these laws? Why don't we know these things, right? I mean, to me, that should be part of the conversation as well.
Well, there's a couple of things there too, because in the report of 24, and I think the number was 9, they said that property was never surrendered, but no explanation as to what that meant. The other thing that's hypocritical about ERPO is that you can only declare somebody suicidal or homicidal if they have a gun license. Because if you don't have a gun license, this entire system is useless. Because all it does, the only remedy a court has is to take your gun license away. So you can't ERPO a friend who you think might be in trouble and isn't getting the help they need because there's no guns to take away. I mean, how hypocritical is that? So, yeah there's a lot here in the article. I think you nailed it, because I call this the emperor's new clothes, and maybe the younger crowd won't understand what that means, but it's the emperor's new clothes, but only cruel and dangerous, because you're telling everybody you're taking care of a situation with this massive set of laws. I mean, we set aside the red flag law within chapter 135 for a long time because it was so voluminous that it was going to distract us from everything else we had to pay attention to. We finally did. And oh my goodness, what a huge set of section after section of law that's virtually meaningless, but they get to pat themselves on the back forever because they passed it.
Yeah. All right. Well, Jim, there's always plenty to talk about when we reach out to you in the Second Amendment battleground state of Massachusetts. I appreciate you joining us on the program today. Folks, want more information about all of the litigation, the legislation, goal.org. That is the website, right?
Absolutely. Goal.org. Yep. And follow us. We got Facebook. We got X. We got Instagram. I don't know what else.
If you're not on TikTok, I guess you could be on TikTok now that it looks like the ban has gone away. All right. Well, Jim, again, thank you so much for your time today, sir. Look forward to doing this again very soon.
Thanks, Cam.
All right. We'll talk to you soon. Jim Wallace from the Gun Owners Action League here on Bearing Arms, Cam and Company. My thanks to Jim for joining us on the program. And we're going to actually have him back next week because there's some interesting stuff going on with the firearm rosters in Massachusetts. You know, this is part of 135, Chapter 135. They changed the definition of firearm to include long guns, which makes sense. But under Massachusetts law, every firearm that is sold at retail has to be certified, has to be on this roster, right? So now they basically have to test certify every rifle or shotgun out there, or look for a way around that mandate. And that's, again, a conversation worth having with Jim. So we're going to have him back on the program next week. Right now, let's turn our attention to today's Armed Citizen story. Our good deed of the day and our recidivist report. We'll start there with a case out of Rochester Hills, Michigan, where a Pontiac man with a long criminal history recently arraigned on felony charges in connection with a series of thefts and home invasions in Rochester Hills. 36-year-old Frankie Stephen Humpkins charged with 5 counts of attempted home invasion, 2 counts of breaking and entering, 1 count each of credit card fraud, prohibited person possession of a firearm, as well as carrying a concealed weapon. According to CNG newspapers and the Oakland County Prosecutor's Office, according to police detectives, they had investigated more than 25 instances of Humpkins attempting to break into unlocked homes and vehicles in Rochester Hills. Were able to identify him during their investigation and through a tip. Deputies say that Humpkins has 4 prior felony convictions for fraud, breaking and entering, larceny from an automobile, and larceny from a building. He was also out on bond for being a felon in possession of a firearm by a prohibited person in Grand Rapids, Michigan. And he was on probation for being a felon in possession of a firearm from Kent County, Michigan. So, again, here is somebody who I guess you can say, all right, listen. He also, by the way, has 6 prior weapons offenses, 9 prior larceny or breaking and entering charges. I guess you could argue that since none of those previous felony convictions were violent felonies, that maybe it's okay. In fact, maybe it should be required that Mr. Humpkins be released on bond for being a felon possession, right? Again, what's the dangerousness of Mr. Humpkins here? I would argue the prolific nature of his offenses, coupled with the most recent charges, which do include home invasions, right? That to me would indicate a level of dangerousness with Mr. Humpkins that would not exist for somebody like, you know, Brian Range, for example, the Pennsylvania man convicted of falsifying his income on a food stamp application who's not able to possess a firearm 30 years later. And again, you got to wonder, what does it take to keep somebody behind bars in Michigan when a guy in his mid-30s has such a lengthy criminal history and is still out on the street with multiple cases against him? Today's Armed Citizen story from Houston, Texas, where a robbery suspect was fatally shot. The case will not be reviewed by the grand jury, but all indications are the shooter will be cleared. According to My Texas Daily, officers responded to a shooting call about 5 a.m. Early Monday morning, found a 16-year-old robbery suspect with apparent gunshot wounds. According to My Texas Daily, evidence suggested the deceased suspect and another man attempted to rob this business, leading to a shootout with employees. The second suspect then fled on foot. None of the employees were injured. Authorities are still seeking information on the identity of the second suspect. But again, if you are where you have a right to be, somebody comes in armed with a gun, starts shooting at you, trying to rob the place, you do have the ability to fight back in self-defense. And it sounds like that's what happened here. So we'll keep our eyes open for any more details as they become available. And finally, today in the right place, at the right time, we're able to do the right thing. A Wisconsin man who saved two people from a fiery car crash in Neenah, Wisconsin on Monday night. Tanner Otter said he heard a loud banging sound. He ran outside of his apartment to see what had happened. According to a police in the town of Neenah, a vehicle had basically run over a fire hydrant, then went down an embankment and hit a tree. Otter says, I saw a car sitting on the side, a lady screaming for help. So instantly I ran back inside, I put on my snow gear, I grabbed my phone, I hopped into my tow truck and I hauled over to her. He could see where the car was, but there was a fence in between, you know, the road where he is and the tree where the car ended up. So he had to get in his car, make it to the crash scene. He said he used a fire extinguisher to put out the flames that at that point were coming from the car's engine, and then helped a woman down from on top of the car because it was on its side. So she was able to crawl out, I guess, through one of the side windows. He then had to, he said, I got the wife off, but the main one was the husband who was still inside the car. He said flames were starting to re-engulf the car. I was worried I wasn't going to be able to get him out in time, but thank God the cop, who happened to be a deputy from Winnebago County, got on scene when he did, because without his help, Otter says, I wouldn't have gotten him out. It was about 8 below zero when Otter and the first responders made the rescue. Otter said, I didn't have gloves on. My hands were almost frostbitten. He said, at that point in time, I didn't think anything else to grab. I just wanted to get out there and rescue them because I saw the smoke from the car. Both individuals ended up going to the hospital for treatment. The female passenger had been released. But as of Tuesday night, the male driver is still in the hospital with the unknown injuries. They don't know what caused the crash at this point. But again, thanks to the quick thinking and the fast action of Tanner Otter in the right place at the right time and able to do the right thing, both of these individuals did survive that fiery crash. All right, that's going to do it for this edition of Bearing Arms, Cam and Company. I want to thank you for being a part of the program as always. I'm looking forward to being back with you again tomorrow. We are tentatively scheduled to have John Petrolino join us from SHOT Show out in Las Vegas. It's always iffy if the internet connection is going to be strong enough at SHOT Show to allow for a video interview, but we're keeping our fingers crossed. Regardless, I hopefully will be back tomorrow as well, unless I start feeling tons worse, and I hope that's not the case, but we're just going to go ahead and assume that I'll see you tomorrow. And don't forget to check out BearingArms.com throughout the rest of the day, keeping you up to date on all of the latest Second Amendment news and information from all across the nation. If you like what you see, I'd encourage you to become a VIP or VIP Gold member as well. VIP Platinum, too, for that matter. And we'll see you back here soon. Until then, be well, be safe, and be free.